Hello, it's time to read from the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, September 19th, 2020. My name is John Reif, and I'll be bringing you the news today. Here's a look at what I'll, here's what I'll be reading. First, we'll start with the front page stories, then move to the inside stories for more local fare. At the 20-minute mark, we'll read any letters to the editor in the opinion page. At the 30-minute mark, the obituaries, followed by sports and more feature stories, wrapping up with Dear Abby. First, taking a look at the weather for today, partly sunny and increasingly windy, a high of 77 degrees today, the winds out of the south-southeast at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Mainly clear and breezy tonight, a low of 57, winds still south-southeast at 10 to 20. Partly sunny and windy tomorrow, a high of 82 degrees, the wind south at 15 to 25 miles per hour. For Sunday, Sunday night's low of 57, and Monday breezy in the morning with some sunshine and a high of 82 degrees, winds out of the south at 8 to 16 miles an hour. Monday night's low of 58 degrees and very warm with sun and some clouds on Tuesday, a high of 85. Tuesday night's low of 56, and for Wednesday, very warm with partial sunshine, a high of 84 degrees for Wednesday. Now let's take a look at the mini editorial for today. This is by John Quinlan of Sioux City, and it reads as follows. Friday's mini editorial writer forgot about last year's record-breaking brush fires in Australia or the horrendous fires in Russia, Thailand, and elsewhere in the world. Kind of short-sighted. Again, that from John Quinlan of Sioux City. The top story on the front page, Justice Ginsburg dies at 87. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a diminutive yet towering women's rights champion who became the court's second female justice, died Friday at her home in Washington. She was 87. Ginsburg died of complications from metastatic pancreatic cancer, the court said. Ginsburg's death just over 6 weeks before Election Day is likely to set off a heated battle over whether President Donald Trump should nominate and the Republican-led Senate should confirm her replacement, or if the seat should remain vacant until the outcome of his race against Democrat Joe Biden is known. Ginsburg announced in July that she was undergoing chemotherapy, treatment for lesions on her liver, the latest of her several battles with cancer. Former chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Iowa Senator Charles Grassley, talked about Ginsburg's record as a trailblazer in legal circles. For more than a quarter century on the highest court in the land, Justice Ginsburg fought tirelessly for greater justice, equality, and opportunity for all people. She was a trailblazer in so many ways and for so many people. Her sharp legal mind, tenacity, and resilience leave a remarkable imprint on our nation, and her legacy will live on for generations to come. Barbara and I join our nation in mourning her passing, Grassley said. Grassley is a senior member of the Judiciary Committee. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican from Iowa, also a member of the Judiciary Committee, released a statement on the passing of Justice Ginsburg. Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a force to be reckoned with. She was an iconic figure who blazed a trail for her work for working moms, graciously balancing her life and family. Justice Ginsburg held deep philosophical views of the world while maintaining genuine friendships that were blind to politics. My heart is with Justice Ginsburg's children, Jane and James, their entire family, and the loved ones she leaves behind. May she rest in peace, according to Ernst. Ginsburg spent her final years on the bench as the unquestioned leader of the court's liberal wing and became something of a rock star to her admirers. Young women especially seemed to embrace the court's Jewish grandmother, affectionately calling her the notorious RBG for her defense of the rights of women and minorities and the strength and resilience she displayed in the face of personal loss and health crises. Those health issues included 5 bouts with cancer beginning in 1999, falls that resulted in broken ribs, insertion of a stent to clear a blocked artery, and assorted other hospitalizations after she turned 75. She resisted calls by liberals to retire during Barack Obama's presidency at a time when Democrats held the Senate and a replacement with similar views could have been confirmed. Instead, President Donald Trump will almost certainly try to push Ginsburg's successor through the Republican-controlled Senate and move the conservative court even more to the right. Ginsburg antagonized Trump during the 2016 presidential campaign in a series of media interviews, including calling him a faker. She soon apologized. Her appointment by President Bill Clinton in 1993 was the first by a Democrat in 26 years. She initially found a comfortable ideological home somewhere left of center on a conservative court dominated by Republican appointees. Her liberal voice grew stronger the longer she served. Ginsburg was a mother of two, an opera lover, and an intellectual who watched arguments behind oversized glasses for many years, though she ditched them for more fashionable frames in her later years. At argument sessions in the ornate courtroom, she was known for digging deep into case records and for being a stickler for following the rules. She argued six key cases before the court in the 1970s when she was an architect of the women's rights movement. She won five. Ruth Bader Ginsburg does not need a seat on the Supreme Court to earn her place in the American history books, Clinton said at the time of her appointment. She has already done that. On the court, where she was known as a facile writer, her most significant majority opinions were the 1996 ruling that ordered the Virginia Military Institute to accept women or give up its state funding, and the 2015 decision that upheld independent commissions some states use to draw congressional districts. Besides civil rights, Ginsburg took an interest in capital punishment, voting repeatedly to limit its use. During her tenure, the court declared it unconstitutional for states to execute the intellectually disabled and killers younger than 18. In addition, she questioned the quality of lawyers for poor accused murderers. In the most divisive of cases, including the Bush versus Gore decision in 2000, she was often at odds with the court's more conservative members. Initially, Chief Justice William H. Rehnquist and Justices Sandra Day O'Connor, Antonin Scalia, Anthony M. Kennedy, and Clarence Thomas. The division remained the same after John Roberts replaced Rehnquist as Chief Justice, Samuel Alito took O'Connor's seat, and under Trump, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh joined the court in seats that have been held by Scalia and Kennedy, respectively. Ginsburg would say later that the 5-4 decision that settled the 2000 presidential election for Republican George W. Bush was a, quoting here, breathtaking episode at the court. She was perhaps personally closest on the court to Scalia, her ideological opposite. Ginsburg once explained that she took Scalia's sometimes biting dissents as a challenge to be met. "How am I going to answer this in a way that's a real put-down?" she said. Scalia died in 2016. Ginsburg authored powerful dissents of her own in cases of involving abortion, voting rights, and pay discrimination against women. She said some were aimed at swaying the opinions of her fellow judges, while others were, quoting here, an appeal to the intelligence of another day, in the hopes that they would provide guidance to future courts. "Hope springs eternal," she said in 2007, "and when I am writing a dissent, I'm always hoping for that fifth or sixth vote, even though I'm disappointed more often than not." She wrote memorably in 2013 that the court's decision to cut out a key part of the federal law that ensured the voting rights of black people, Hispanics, and other minorities was, quoting here, "like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet." Change on the court hit Ginsburg especially hard. She dissented forcefully from the court's decision in 2007 to uphold a nationwide ban on an abortion procedure that opponents call partial birth abortion. The court, with O'Connor still on it, had struck down a similar state ban 7 years earlier. "The alarming ruling," Ginsburg said, and again quoting here, "cannot be understood as anything other than an effort to chip away at a right declared again and again by this court, and with increasing comprehension of its centrality to women's lives." On the front page, it shows a picture of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg applauding after a performance in her honor after she spoke about her life and work during a discussion April 6, 2018 at Georgetown Law School in Washington. Again, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg dying at 87. Next story on the front page, ribbon cutting at Expo Center. Organizers hope the new facility will host 14 major events annually. This by Brett Hayworth, Dateline Sioux City. Almost immediately after the dignitaries took turns extolling the virtues of the Siouxland Expo Center in a special ribbon cutting to open the $15 million facility, three boys did sprints on the field turf. Evan Christensen, 10, of North Sioux City, said the really big facility will be a great place for sports on the off days when trade shows and conventions aren't being held on the 80,000 square feet arena at 550 South Lafayette Street. Brady Braunschweig, 10, of Dakota Dunes, was one of the other sprinting boys, and he is the son of Jim Braunschweig, who is vice president of the Siouxland Expo Center Board of Directors. The Expo Board shepherded the project that included a combination of donors who covered two pages of names, plus funding from the Sioux City's Reinvestment District, which is diverting nearly $14 million in future hotel/motel and sales tax money into unique projects designed to increase tourism and quality of life. Debbie Durham, a Sioux Cityan who is the Iowa Economic Development Authority Director, was effusive in her comments on what the center could mean for the city. Sioux City has been reinvesting itself for years. The community does not stand still. Quality of life is what we are celebrating here today, Durham said. She pointed to recent improvements to the city Cone Park and planned improvements along the Missouri Riverfront area that will cost several million dollars. Local leaders have been working for more than a decade to bring an ag-focused expo center to Woodbury County, with the talks originally to have it in Mauville, 15 miles east of Sioux City. But after some problems with placing it there by 2013 and costs rose to around $17 million, millions above earlier estimates, organizers were forced to downsize the project and change its emphasis. The word ag was dropped from the building name, reflecting not only the reduced emphasis on equestrian shows, but also the broader events envisioned for the center. The goal is for the Expo Center to host 14 major events annually. The first events will be held Saturday when a youth soccer league will play games. The facility is located in the former Sioux City Stockyards on a parcel bounded by Interstate 29 and the Floyd River Channel. Dirk Laurie, president of the Siouxland Expo Center Board, didn't mince words, asserting, "This is the best expo center ever." He said it was a great choice for the way to breathe new air into the Stockyards area. "This center will make our lives healthier, happier, and better," Laurie said, pausing ever so slightly before adding, "Yeah, that's cool." Retractable bleachers that will seat nearly 1,400 on the arena's ground floor. Just inside the north entrance, a black-and-white photo mural featuring Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig covers a lobby wall from when Ruth's Bustin' Babes and Gehrig's Larrapin' Lou's played a game at Stockyards Park in 1927. Great Southern Bank contributed $250,000 to become the naming sponsor for the athletic field. Other organizations that have made financial commitments for naming rights include Missouri River Historical Development, Mid-American Energy, and the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Sioux City. In the front page, it shows a picture inside the completed Expo Center. It says members of the public get a first look at the newly completed Siouxland Expo Center during a grand opening ceremony Friday in Sioux City. Looking at the final page, final story on the front page, more classes move online. As COVID cases rise, Sioux City schools make switch. This by Brad Hayworth and Dateline Sioux City. 10 days after the first shift to classroom learning due to reported positive cases of the novel coronavirus, classrooms in six more Sioux City elementary schools are moving from in-person to online learning. The five school buildings with impacted classrooms are spread throughout the city. They include a fifth grade and multi-grade specialty class at Liberty, fifth grade in Irving, a multi-grade class in Los Hills, a multi-grade class at Riverside, and a fifth grade section at Sunnyside, according to a news release Friday from the district. In its weekly summary of COVID-19 cases, The district also disclosed Friday that 15 of its 22 school buildings had at least one positive test for the virus. This list includes all three middle schools and two of the three high schools, East and West. The impacted schools also include Clark, Hunt, Morningside, Perry Creek, and Unity Elementary Schools. For the week ended Friday, 9 students and 17 employees tested positive, according to the district's website. In addition to the school buildings, positive cases were also recorded in the district's administrative headquarters downtown and in its central maintenance building. The implementation of the district's emergency plan for the classrooms in the 6 elementary schools came as the average rate of positive tests for the virus in Woodbury County climbed to 14.8% on Friday. That nearly matches the minimum 15% rate established by the Iowa Department of Education, in which school districts can ask to move entire school buildings from in-person to 100% virtual learning. Except in those instances, the state requires districts to offer at least 50% of instruction in-person. Back on September 9th, a classroom of Sioux City second grade students was moved from in-school to online learning after several pupils in the Nodland Elementary School tested positive for the novel coronavirus or exhibited symptoms of the virus. The initial plan was for the Nodland students to return to school on September 23rd. In a statement to the Journal, Sioux City School Board President Jeremy Saint said board members are keeping a close eye on the 14-day rolling average of cases. I'm not sure that we are to a point where the board needs to consider a change in our district-wide response. However, we need to continue to follow through on the commitment to safety that we adopted in our return to learn plan, continue to monitor the situation closely, and remain flexible to make changes in our response quickly if needed, Saint said. Saint said the most recent data shows cases in schools are a small percentage compared to the overall community rate, and there is not a concentration of cases in any one area. The district is continuing the Friday practice of releasing the number of positive cases determined within the district over each week. Last week, the report was that 4 students and 4 staff members in the district had tested positive for the novel coronavirus. In the first week, 2 employees tested positive, and the second week, the results showed 5 pupils and 7 staffers tested positive. The district continues to take steps such as extensive cleaning and sanitizing places that are heavily used in buildings. 2 more people have died from COVID-19 in the metro area, as the deaths of the Woodbury County residents were reported Friday. According to the Siouxland District Health Department, the 2 people who died were women older than 80 years old. The county's death toll from COVID-19 now stands at 61. The county also reported 61 new positive test cases of the novel coronavirus Friday. Overall, there have been 4,850 cases in Woodbury County. Cases have climbed more sharply in recent days in Woodbury and Dakota counties. Thursday marked the largest single-day Woodbury County increase in some time, with 87 new positive cases reported. It shows the inset graphs with the number of presumptive cases of coronavirus continuing to rise in the Siouxland states. In South Dakota, overall 18,085 cases. Nebraska has 40,387 cases. And Iowa with 78,558 cases. Those numbers are as of 7:30 p.m. Friday, and the source is the state public health departments. In the Siouxland COVID-19 cases by county, in South Dakota, it shows Yankton with 335 cases, 4 deaths. Clay County with 529 cases and 5 deaths. Union County with 341 cases and 6 deaths. In Nebraska, Cedar County with 76, Dixon with 98 cases and 2 deaths, Wayne with 128 cases, Thurston with 281 cases and 4 deaths, and Dakota County with 2,120 and 43 deaths. In Iowa, Lyon County has 227 cases, 3 deaths, Osceola with 121 cases, Dickinson with 475 cases and 6 deaths, Sioux County with 1,265 cases and 3 deaths. O'Brien, 286 with 9 deaths. Clay County with 277 and 3 deaths. Plymouth County has 989 cases, 20 deaths. Cherokee with 177 cases, 2 deaths. Buena Vista at 1,933 cases and 12 deaths. Ida County with 83, Sac with 194, Monona County with 128 cases, 1 death, Crawford County with 972 cases and 4 deaths, and Woodbury County, of course, still in the lead, 4,850 cases and 61 deaths. Okay, it's time now for the opinion page, and today is Other Voices from the Omaha World Herald. It's titled, Centrists Can Help Heal Our Sick in Politics, again by the Omaha World Herald. Not to discount its credible candidates in 2 congressional districts this fall, but Ben Sasse is right in wishing that the Nebraska Democratic Party was healthier. Nebraska's junior U.S. Senator told the World Herald's Aaron Sanderford that a stronger Democratic Party would make it harder for him and his fellow Republicans to campaign by merely preaching to the choir. Safe seats in either chamber of Congress allow or force politicians to play to the extremes of their party, offering ideas they know won't pass, as Sanderford summarized Sasse's thinking, to play for the political theater on TV. This is easy for Sasse to say, of course. He's going to waltz to re-election against an opponent, Chris Janicek, who is doomed to defeat even before he sent appalling text messages to a campaign staffer and was disavowed by Nebraska Democrats. In a statewide race, anyone with an R after his or her name is almost certain to sweep to victory. As the nation has become more divided, Nebraska has become more deeply red, in part reflecting the rural-urban split. Our political culture has become nationalized and so riddled with cynicism and anger that many people have gotten out of the habit, at the state and local level, of judging candidates by their actual qualities. Opportunities to elect capable public servants are needlessly lost. It wasn't long ago that this wasn't the case in Nebraska. Ben Nelson's stretch as governor and U.S. senator ended only about 8 years ago. When Nelson beat newcomer Pete Ricketts in 2006, the last significant statewide win for a Nebraska Democrat, it was the 6th Democratic victory in 8 U.S. Senate elections. Nelson followed the same path to the governor's mansion and then the Senate, as Bob Kerrey and J.J. Exon, the latter of whom was eulogized by this newspaper as, quoting here, showing Democrats how they could succeed in Nebraska, be true to the better nature of their party while respecting the political traditions and impulses of all Nebraskans. What is lost when Democrats lack this kind of connection across the state is simply accountability for those who win. Ben Sasse, for example, can do a high school commencement speech so off the mark that his home school district in Fremont disavows the commencement address and never offer a word of apology or explanation. He can write in the Wall Street Journal that senators should no longer be directly elected by the people but by state legislators and to 12-year terms, and it won't cost him a vote. The political traditions and impulses that Jim Exon embodied reflected Nebraska's tradition of real populism, standing up for people's interests first, the reason we have public utilities, for example, before populism became code for nationalism. It was Republican George Norris who advocated for public utilities, who brought us a one-house legislature, and who, at times, supported Democrats. The greatest curse of the present day is the party spirit which controls the judgment and minds of the people contrary to their own convictions, Norris wrote, in 1928. We desperately need centrists in both parties who avoid brainwashed partisan bomb-throwing so we may find solutions. And we need voters who, regardless of party, can step away from the partisan chatter, advertising, and social media to evaluate for themselves those who have chosen to run. It is something individual voters can do to make our politics and our state better. Again, that's from the Omaha World Herald and Other Voices on the opinion page. Moving now to page A3, farmers to get added $14 billion. USDA says it will give farmers compensation for COVID pandemic. The federal government said Friday that it will give farmers an additional $14 billion to compensate them for the difficulties they have experienced selling their crops, milk, and meat because of the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. Department of Agriculture released details of its plan that it said will provide financial assistance that gives producers the ability to absorb increased marketing costs associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. President Donald Trump first mentioned the aid in a speech Thursday night in Wisconsin, a presidential battleground state that is considered vital for his chances to win a second term. The additional payments illustrate the importance of farmers as a voting bloc to Trump's reelection. He addressed them in Wisconsin directly, saying, "You gotta love Trump," and promising favorable trade and regulatory changes, as well as tax cuts. "Now we have to get four more years to cement it and do additional things," he said. The coronavirus pandemic has created several problems for farmers. Lowered availability of labor has reduced crop and livestock production, as well as processing capacity in meatpacking plants and other facilities. These problems have pushed prices that farmers receive for commodities lower. They've also seen a drop in demand for some products as fewer people have been eating out. Farm households also have suffered from loss of income from off-farm jobs that they used to fund farm production needs, household living expenses, and payments on farm business debt. Agriculture groups applauded the additional money, much of which will come in direct payments for crops that meet a specified threshold of price decline. They include corn, soybeans, wheat, and some cotton. Chicken, eggs, milk, beef, cattle, pigs, and lambs also will be covered, as will tobacco, wool, alfalfa, oats, peanuts, rice, and hemp. Farmers can begin signing up for the money on Monday. "We listened to feedback received from farmers, ranchers, and agricultural organizations about the impact of the pandemic on our nation's farms and ranches, and we developed a program to better meet the needs of those impacted," Agriculture Secretary Perdue said in a statement. "The program places a payment cap of $250,000 per person or farm entity for all commodities combined. Gross income can't be more than $900,000, unless at least 75% or more of their income is derived from farming, ranching, or forestry-related activities." Also on page A3, Chair of Honor placed in new expo center. This is by Brett Hayworth, Dateline Sioux City. A special chair has been placed in the new Siouxland Expo Center that opened Friday as a way to commemorate military members who became prisoners of war or have been missing in action. The POW/MIA Chair of Honor is a relatively new endeavor in a few places nationwide, in essence to remember the military personnel until they come home. The chairs are meant to represent those service members who are unable to fill them because of their sacrifices. Officials who dedicated the chair said it is important that POWs and those missing in action not be forgotten, so they are pleased the Expo Center will have the chair in a place that will be seen by a lot of people. "This is one of the first locations nationwide," said U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican from Iowa, who joined Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott and U.S. Representative Steve King, Republican from Iowa, as the main speakers. The event, which took place on National POW/MIA Recognition Day, was moderated by Jacob McGowan, son of Siouxland Chamber of Commerce CEO Chris McGowan. Jacob McGowan, a high school junior, began working in earnest in June to bring the Chair of Honor to Sioux City, which got off the ground with a July 4th donation by Bob Scott. "This program makes a lot of sense for our community," Mayor Scott said. There will actually be two chairs in the city, a permanent one at the Expo Center and a second one that will be stored at the Chamber of Commerce building for access by community groups and special future events. Officials will attempt to add even more chairs in the months ahead in the city. Beginning with McGowan, several mentions were made about a notable Sioux City prisoner of war, the late Brigadier General George Bud Day. He was a retired Air Force colonel and a Medal of Honor recipient at the time of his death, and was posthumously promoted to Brigadier General in 2018. Day earned more than 70 medals for his service during World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. He spent nearly 6 years as a POW in Vietnam. King reminded people that in March he began the quest to rename the post office in Sioux City for Day. The congressman introduced H.R. 6095, which seeks to designate the post office at 214 Jackson Street, the General George Bud Day Post Office Building. After the event, King told the Journal he anticipates the measure could be passed in the House this year. It shows in the inset picture Sioux City resident Jacob McGowan, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, U.S. Representative Steve King, and Sioux City Mayor Bob Scott pulling back the covering to show the POWMIA Chair of Honor at the Siouxland Expo Center on Friday. Such honor chairs are meant to represent those service members who are unable to fill them because of their sacrifices. Looking at briefs, man charged with sex abuse. A Sergeant Bluff man has been charged with felonies relating to a sex abuse case that occurred in Sioux City. On April 28th, the Sioux City Police Department received a report of sex abuse. A 12-year-old victim reported that she had conversations of a sexual nature on a social media account with an adult male, police said. The victim agreed to meet up with a man who allegedly agreed to pay the victim in exchange for sex acts. Following an investigation, Andrew D. Sanders, 28, was charged with sexual abuse in the third degree, lascivious acts, enticing away a child, and soliciting prostitution. Anyone with more information on this crime or any other crime can contact Crime Stoppers at 712-258-8477. That's 712-258-TIPS. Also a correction on here, Shahi India Grill, an editor's choice for Asian or ethnic food, was inadvertently omitted from the Siouxland's top 50 restaurants section, which was inserted into the Journal Friday. Rebos, which was named one of the top fine dining restaurants, and Crystal Cafe Truck Stop, one of the top entries for diner fare, were also inadvertently omitted from the section. It's time now to look at the obituaries, only from Cherokee. Doris M. Kintig, that's K-I-N-T-I-G-H, might be Kintai, 88 years old, passed away Tuesday, September 8th. A memorial service will be September 15th, 1:30 p.m. at Memorial Presbyterian Church in Cherokee. Burial will be at Grand Meadow Cemetery in Ouachita, Iowa. Boothby Funeral Home of Cherokee is handling those arrangements. The six-month annualized change in the index improved to negative 6.3% in July from a revised negative 7.1% in June. It is the 21st consecutive month of a negative value and the fifth month below a minus 2.0% change, officials said. The Iowa Non-Farm Employment Coincident Index recorded a 0.51% decline in July, the eighth month in a row of decline, and the fourth largest one-month drop in the 20-year history, behind only April, May, and June of this year, according to the monthly department report. The decline strongly suggests the Iowa economy will continue to weaken throughout the first quarter of fiscal 2021, and employment growth will weaken over the next 3 to 6 months, state officials said. The four positive index components in July were residential building permits, the new orders index, diesel fuel consumption, and average manufacturing hours. Components that dropped in the index were average weekly unemployment claims, which were inverted, the national yield spread, agricultural futures profits index, and the Iowa stock market index. Moving now to the sports page and the front page story on the sports section. Last second victory. Warriors score with 3 seconds remaining. This is by Zach James, Dateline Sergeant Bluff. Neither Caden Helt nor Tyler Smith were not going to let his Sergeant Bluff Luton High School teammates suffer a second straight loss. Helt, the Warriors' senior running back, had 4 long touchdowns Friday to help give SBL a 42-35 win at home against Boyd and Hull Rock Valley in a Class 3A district football game. Smith, SBL's quarterback, took the ball in from the 10-yard line with 3 seconds remaining to give the Warriors the thrilling win. Helt, meanwhile, had 5 touchdowns, including the go-ahead one with 2 minutes 32 seconds remaining. That was a 5-yard touchdown reception on third down from Smith. But the Nighthawks had an answer, which led to Smith's eventual game-winning score. Smith also found Helt on a 23-yard play down the BHRV sideline to set up the red zone opportunity. His fourth touchdown came from 53 yards with just under 8 minutes remaining in the game. Three of Helt's rushing TDs came in the first half. The Nighthawks scored on a one-yard run to take the early lead. Helt's first long touchdown run came with the Warriors were down in the first quarter. It came on a second down and 11 to go. The Warriors' offense gave Helt a nice hole in the middle to run through, and he went 75 yards for the score with 5:51 left in the first quarter. Helt's second TD run of the night was from 55 yards. That scoring play came with 1:55 left in the first quarter. That play also was on the second play of a drive, but that play was on a first down. The Warriors and the Nighthawks traded scoreless drives for nearly a full quarter, that is until Helt scored his third TD of the night. Helt scored from 63 yards with 97 seconds left in the first half. The Warriors were working on a long drive which started from their own one-yard line. BHRV had been building a drive, but two penalties set them back to a 3rd-and-19 situation at the SBL 31. That forced Nighthawks quarterback Caleb Katz to throw a deep ball into the end zone. Warriors defensive back Ty Shoulders read the play well, however, and the Warriors senior picked off the pass at the one. The Nighthawks forced the Warriors to third down on that drive, but Katz was called for pass interference on the play, and that kept the drive going. Later, BHRV's defense forced the Warriors to punt from the 20, but the Nighthawks were called for running into the kicker. That gave the Warriors another chance at a first down. Three plays after the Nighthawks penalty, Helt made the Nighthawks pay with his third rushing TD of the night. In his three TD runs alone, Helt ran for a combined yardage of 193 yards. Entering the game, Helt had 17 carries on 90 yards in two games against West and Lewis Central. In the third quarter, Katz found Noble for two separate passing TDs for 19 and 9 yards. Those two scores helped the Nighthawks catch up with the Warriors. BHRV needed 7 minutes and 30 seconds and 10 combined plays to score those two touchdowns. The Nighthawks tied it at 28-28 after Helt's fourth touchdown on a 45-yard reception by Landon Van Kekerix. Van Kekerix caught the pass around the 25-yard line, and he eluded the Warriors' defense and found the end zone. Van Kekerix later had a big catch that set up Noble's 7-yard scoring run with 1:43 left. But the Warriors had the answer with Smith's 10-yard touchdown run with 3 seconds left for the win. What a cool game. The inset pictures show BHRV's Cody Noble reaching to recover his fumbled ball during Sergeant Bluff Luton versus Boyd in Whole Rock Valley football action Friday in Sergeant Bluff. And the top big picture shows BHRV's Bryson Van Grootenheist brought down by Sergeant Bluff Luton's Garrett McHugh during Sergeant Bluff Luton Boyd and Holds game Friday in Sergeant Bluff. Moving to some girls volleyball. Once again, Sioux County is home to a number of top 10 ranked volleyball teams in Northwest Iowa. The Sioux County Pizza Ranch Volleyball Tournament takes place on Saturday at MOC Floyd Valley, and every team at the tournament is ranked. Western Christian, MOC Floyd Valley, Boyd and Hull, Unity Christian, Sioux Center, and Sioux Falls Christian. Western Christian and Sioux Falls Christian are defending state champions. The Siouxland area also features a Galen Catholic team that is ranked and was at the state tournament last season, and Newell Fonda, who is ranked in Class 1A. As per usual, Western Christian is defending Class 2A state champion. Also per usual, the Wolfpack is looking to add to the trophy case, even though they graduated a talented senior class last season, led by Olivia Granstra, McKay Van Hull, McKenna Quima, Corey Winya, and Abby and Allie Postma. However, head coach Tammy Verbeek had plenty of talent behind those talented starters, and the Wolfpack are off to a 5-4 start already, with three of those losses coming at the Vaulted Bellevue tournament and another coming against Class 4A defending state champion Sergeant Bluff Luton. Western Christian is ranked number 1 in Class 2A currently. "We are still hopeful and we still have big goals," Verbeek said. "We are going to get back to work and keep doing the things we need to do to get better. We feel we have the pieces to contend and make another state appearance. It's going to take hard work." Granstra was an all-state setter last season and started for Verbeek since her freshman season, but she is now playing in the back row for Northwestern. Verbeek knows the new center at Western Christian well, junior Jalen Van Dyken, who is Verbeek's niece, as is defensive specialist Lydia Van Cly. Van Dyken has 177 assists already, as Western Christian is hitting .180 on the season. It's neat to have some family out there. We're super happy to have her back. She was gone a year, Verbeek said. We just have to find consistency in our system. Once we find consistency, we will be dangerous. We just aren't quite there yet. Sophomore Stella Winterfield, who had one kill all of last season, leads the Wolfpack with 69 kills this season. Senior Sienna Moss has 52 kills, and sophomore Abby Verberg has 42 kills. Moss and junior Emma Westfall have 19 and 10 total blocks, respectively. In the back row, senior Madison Viss has slid from a defensive specialist role to the libero. She has 86 digs so far this season. Madison is the only person we have back from our serve-receive, our primary passers, Verbeek said. Going to some college football, Ryan likes game week feeling. Mustangs Red Raiders meet to start season. This is by Zach James, Dateline Sioux City. Amid all the chaos happening around the COVID-19 pandemic, Morningside College football coach Steve Ryan acknowledged this week finally felt like a game week. The two-time national champion Mustangs will start their season at 7 p.m. Saturday at home as they'll welcome the Northwestern Red Raiders to start the season at Elwood Olsen Stadium. Morningside and all the other Great Plains Athletic Conference schools will play a league-only schedule this fall. Mustangs coach Steve Ryan couldn't really pinpoint a moment when it hit him that this week would be ending with a game, but like all other coaches during the pandemic, Ryan is thankful to have the chance to play football in 2020. It's just incredible that we're getting going, Ryan said. You're out there for a while and it feels like a game week. The players just have the energy that there's a game on the horizon. This moment has finally reached us that we get a chance to play. You're looking forward to plans being made about an opponent you're going to play. The Mustangs schedule happens to start off against the Red Raiders. Last season, the two teams ended the regular season against each other in what ended up being the GPAC title game, which the Mustangs won. Morningside beat its season opening opponent, St. Francis of Illinois, by a score of 80-0. The game on Saturday night will likely have a closer margin since the Red Raiders have been a top 10 team over the past few seasons. And Ryan has told the Mustangs to expect a nail-and-tooth game against the Red Raiders. It's going to be a hard-fought rivalry game, and that's the nature of rivalry games, Ryan said. Northwestern came out really good last year, and we didn't make plays early on. Our number one message is to take care of the football. We need to make good decisions with the football. We are constantly telling them to play with great energy. Morningside won that contest 37-27 thanks to a third-quarter push from the Mustangs' offense. The Mustangs have won six consecutive games against the Red Raiders. Northwestern's last win against Morningside was in 2013. When asked what it was like to have the Morningside versus Northwestern be the first game of the season, Ryan responded with a laugh. I don't know. Ask me after the game on Saturday night. In a more serious tone, Ryan complimented Northwestern's talented roster, ranked fifth in a preseason poll, and knows it'll be a challenge to start the season. It's good to have an opponent that gets your guys' attention, Ryan said. It gets them ready and gets them prepared for what they have to do. I also think coming out of COVID, nobody has scrimmages, nobody has spring ball, so you really don't know what you've got. The Red Raiders returned 16 starters to last year's roster. There are seven returning offensively, six on defense, and then three on special teams. Two of the top returners offensively for Northwestern is quarterback Tyson Kuima and receiver Shane Solberg. Kuima, last year's GPAC Offensive Player of the Year, passed for 3,007 yards, 27 touchdowns, and 10 interceptions. He had four 300-yard passing games in 2019. I think for Tyson, the sky's the limit. He's had an outstanding career, and he's continuing to improve and learning to play more in the moment, Northwestern coach Matt McCarty said back in August. We have an opportunity to win every time he is on the field. He's an outstanding competitor, and throughout fall camp, his presence as a leader has grown, and he's playing at a high level. Solberg was second in the GPAC in receptions with 85, and he had the fourth most yards with 1,264. Out of the 11 games played, Solberg had seven games with 100 or more passing yards. Defensively, linebacker Brett Mosier returns, coming off a 60-tackle season, and safety Noah Van Hoof had 55 tackles. It shows an inset picture on page B2 of Morningside's Arnij A.P. Ponder, brought down by St. Xavier's Peyton Nigro, who's number 43, and Ron Carroll, who's number 29. Morningside hosts Northwestern on Saturday. One last local sports story. Morningside wins Mount Marty invite. This is women's golf. After finishing with a 3-11 in round one at the Mount Marty Invite on Thursday, the Morningside women's golf team had an even better day to completely distance itself from the rest of the pack. Morningside finished the second round with a score of 310, giving the Mustangs a two-day score of 621 to win the invite. Morningside finished 57 strokes ahead of the second-place Dakota Wesleyan. Wow. Briarcliff finished in third place with a 691. Northwestern was 6th with 701, and Dort was 11th with a 779. The Mustangs had three of the top four finishers, led by Sam Knight's 151. She had a 75 on Thursday and a 76 on Friday. Maria Nava shot a 79 on Thursday and improved to a 76 on Friday for a 155. And Maria Zorilla finished with 156 for fourth place. Leah Bedosa was 6th with a 162. Tori Soto won the individual title with a 144. Briarcliff was led by Frankie Valencia, who took 11th place with a 168, and Headland tied for 14th with a 171. Emily Harst carried a 179 to finish in 23rd. Kate Winya led Northwestern with a top 10 showing. Winya finished with a 165 and finished in 10th place. Haley Carlson finished in 16th place with a 172. Riley Brown led Dort with his 22nd place finish with a 178. Oops, I said I had last sports, but I got a little bit more sports. This is some high school prep football. Stars pick up lopsided win over Thomas Jefferson, Council Bluffs, Iowa. North dominated on both sides of the ball as the Stars bounced back from a lopsided loss to Bishop Heelan to win by a lopsided score over Council Bluffs' Thomas Jefferson on Friday. North beat the Yellow Jackets 55-7 in Council Bluffs. The Stars are now 2-1 going into its rivalry game against 2-1 East next week. The Stars scored on their opening drive as they got an 8-yard touchdown from Brady Wawrzymek for a 7-0 lead. Then on the Yellow Jackets' ensuing possession, Dante Hansen picked off a pass and went 41 yards for the touchdown. Austin McLean then recovered a fumble on the Yellow Jackets' next possession. The Stars took advantage again as Gavin Haig hit Hansen for a 47-yard touchdown pass for a 21-0 lead with 6:07 left in the first quarter. Jack Lloyd added a 24-yard field goal toward the end of the first quarter for a 24-0 lead. Early in the second, Haig threw for another long touchdown, this time to Evan Helvig for a 62-yard scoring strike and a 31-0 lead. Then Haig found Hansen for another touchdown, this time a 43-yard touchdown pass. Haig evened out his touchdown passes to receivers as he hit Helvig for a 14-yard score for a 45-0 lead, which was the halftime score. Haig and Hansen connected for the third touchdown of the game when Hansen hauled in the 33-yard pass for a 52-0 lead. The Yellow Jackets scored on a 4-yard touchdown run in the third quarter for their only score of the game. Lloyd added another field goal to cap the 55-7 win for the Stars. Dakota Valley downs Milbank 48-14. Dakota Valley picked up its first win of the season as the Panthers dominated Milbank for a 48-14 victory. Storm Lake downs Bishop Heelan 34-24. Bishop Heelan had a 10-7 lead over Storm Lake going into halftime, but the Tornadoes scored 27 points in the second half and beat Heelan 34-24 on Friday in Storm Lake. Heelan falls to 1-2 on the season, was coming off a lopsided win over North. Storm Lake picks up its first win of the season and is 1-2. Storm Lake had its first score of the game, but Heelan held the Tornadoes scoreless for the rest of the half and got a safety and touchdowns for a 10-7 halftime lead. Storm Lake put together a long drive in the third quarter and scored to go up 14-10. Both teams added a touchdown each before the end of the third quarter as the Tornadoes went into the fourth up 21-17. Storm Lake got two touchdowns before the six-minute mark to take the 34-17 lead. Heelan put together a nice drive, and Devion West scored from 10 yards out to make it a 34-24 game with 3:55 remaining, but the Tornadoes had a big enough lead and held on for the win. OAB CIG 54, Missouri Valley 0. Griffin Dearson rushed for three scores, and Cooper Dijon had four total touchdowns as the Falcons dominated on both ends of the ball in a 54-0 win over Missouri Valley. The Class 1A top-ranked Falcons improved to 3-0 with the win. Dearson rushed for 121 yards and three scores on six carries, and he had catches for 53 yards. Dijon was 10 of 17 passing for 274 yards and three scores. He ran five times for 74 yards and a score. Easton Harms caught two passes for 97 yards and a touchdown, and Trust Wells had two receptions for 40 yards and a score. Colton Knopp caught two passes for 36 yards and a score. Knopp also had a 25-yard interception return for a touchdown and four tackles. Ethan Shiver had eight solo tackles, and Carson Quirk had five tackles. Bo Neiman added four solo stops. Western Christian down Sibley Ocheyedan 27-7. Tyson Burr passed for three touchdowns to lead the Wolfpack to win over the Generals in Whole Friday. Burr found Sean DeWitt for a 31-yard TD pass with 7:03 left in the first quarter to give Western Christian a 7-0 lead, but the Generals scored to tie the game with 2:14 left in the opening period on a 1-yard run by Dylan Platt. Burr fired touchdown passes to Ty Van Essen and Ethan Sprunk in the second quarter to give the Wolfpack a 20-7 lead at the half. Western Christian's Carson Elbert scored on a 2-yard run with 6:48 left in the game for the only score of the second half. The Wolfpack improves to 3-0, while Sibley Ocheyedan is 0-3. Sioux Center down Sheldon 41-12. Sioux Center was in a tight game with Sheldon as the Warriors held a 14-12 lead, but then Sioux Center took over in the second half, outscoring Sheldon 27-6 to go on to win 41-18. Sioux Center improves to 3-0 on the season, and Sheldon falls to 1-2 on the year. Zach Roseboom rushed for 117 yards and two touchdowns for the Warriors, and he was 3-for-4 passing on 97 yards and two scores. Matthew Baumgars rushed for 160 yards on 14 carries, and he scored twice. Deo Kokemthong hauled in a 24-yard touchdown pass, and Brett Shouten caught a 43-yard touchdown pass. Zach Kokemthong had two sacks and 11.5 total tackles. For Sheldon, Caleb Ackerman rushed for 58 yards and a score, and Brian Bernal and Tyrell Lindemann each rushed for a score. Bernal had 55 yards on the ground. Wrapping up the high school prep scores, South O'Brien downs Hartley Melvin Sanborn 20-12, Galen Catholic 53, Akron Westfield 8, Lyon George Little Rock 21, Unity Christian 0, Allen Downs Bloomfield 34-16, Newell Fonda downs West Bend Mallard 55-0, Underwood downs MVAO COU 51-6, and Alta Aurelia 13, Shenandoah 7. Going back to page A6, seven more Iowa counties eligible for aid from FEMA. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has made assistance available to public entities and nonprofits in seven additional Iowa counties, as well as the Sac and Fox tribe of the Mississippi and Iowa, in the wake of the August 10th derecho, Governor Kim Reynolds said Friday. FEMA officials said Green, Grundy, Guthrie, Hardin, Iowa, Jackson, and Washington counties have been added to a presidential disaster declaration issued August 17th, which made public entities and select nonprofits in 16 counties eligible to apply for the Federal Public Assistance Program. The counties initially approved for public assistance funding are Benton, Boone, Cedar, Clinton, Dallas, Jasper, Johnson, Jones, Lynn, Marshall, Muscatine, Polk, Powishik, Scott, Story, and Tama, according to the governor's office. The Sac and Fox tribe of the Mississippi in Iowa this week received a separate presidential disaster declaration, which made tribe members eligible to apply for the Federal Public Assistance Program. Fundraising for that program may be used for emergency work and the repair or replacement of disaster damaged facilities, officials said. Shows an inset picture of the top of a grain storage bin damaged from the derecho earlier this month, which sits in the middle of a bean field near the Rod Pierce Farm, August 20th, 2020, near Woodward, Iowa. Time now to read from Dear Abby. The first letter is from Thrown Under the Bus, and it's titled Surprise Changes in Plans Strain Women's Friendship. Dear Abby, I have a serious issue with my best girlfriend. We make plans together, adult plans, and then at the last minute, her kids drop the young grandkids off for her to babysit, curtailing any plans we have together. The past few times, we have changed our plans to a kids' activity. I have an extremely busy client load, and I'm losing income by accommodating my friend's time constraints, which revolve around making her husband's lunch and dinner. Although I'm single now, I'm a widow, I do understand why she has her priorities. If her grandkids are there when we have plans, she asks me to pick them up fast food on the way over on my dime. I have kids and grandkids myself, and they are important to me. I'm tired of being held hostage by her adult children who I feel are using her and taking advantage of the drop-in daycare with Nana. How can I talk to her about our time being important too? I have intentionally not made plans with my grandkids if she and I have plans, and I would love some reciprocity. Signed, Throne Under the Bus. Dear Throne, if this happened occasionally, I would advise you to cut your friend some slack. However, because this happens often, tell her your dates with her are carefully scheduled and when she changes them at the last minute, it has a negative impact on you economically. Point out that when you make dates with her, you let her children know they will have to arrange for another babysitter unless it is an emergency. And if the last minute changes continue, see her less often and arrange to socialize with other friends who appreciate your situation. Next letter, last one for today, is by Impatient in Illinois. Dear Abby, I'm about to be 22. I have been talking to a man around my age for almost 6 months now. He tells me how special I am and how much I mean to him, but says he isn't ready for a relationship. We go on dates and do not have relations with other people. He says putting a title on us will give him accountability he doesn't want. He claims to be over his ex, but he often mentions her. I know he was still conversing with her when we first started talking, but he lied about it. I'm not rushing a relationship because I know it takes time to get to know someone, but I want to know if he can see a future with me, and that is a question he will not answer. I have attachment issues and don't want to let him go, but I can't help but feel as if I am not good enough for him, which he says is not the case. Should I move on or wait and see what the future holds? Signed, Impatient in Illinois. Dear Impatient, stop allowing your insecurity issues to affect your common sense. You are both young, and your relationship has been going on for only 6 months. He has been honest by admitting he isn't ready for a relationship or the titles that go with one. He may not answer your questions about a future because he doesn't know the answer, so stop pushing him. He may be more focused on work at this point than romance, and frankly, so should you be. If nothing has changed in another 6 months, consider dating others then. That's it for reading the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, September 12th, 2020. For the last hour, the story has been selected and read by me, John Reef. All material heard on Iris is intended solely for the use of the blind and print handicapped. If you have any questions, call 877-404-4747. We thank you for listening to Iris, your radio reading service.